This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. Happy Lunar New Year's Eve to all who celebrate, and it really is a happy new year for one Chinese company, the startup behind the artificial intelligence chatbot DeepSeek. We're used to hearing about the eccentric side projects of billionaire entrepreneurs. Tesla's Elon Musk and Amazon's Jeff Bezos have both made significant investments in space technology, for instance. But it's the DeepSeek chatbot, a quiet side project from a Chinese tech billionaire, that's upending financial markets and posing a lot of uncomfortable questions in Washington and also Beijing today. It's the brainchild of young entrepreneur Liang Wenfeng, described by partners as a very nerdy guy with a terrible hairstyle. He made his money by training AI to make financial investments. But on the side, he was creating DeepSeek, a remarkably powerful AI chatbot that's overtaken much pricier US competitors. And it's been getting an overwhelming thumbs up by reviewers.
Emergency podcast, everybody. The markets went crazy today due to the DeepSeek phenomenon.
We had to break our production schedules. We shut down the team meeting, everything.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let me just cut to the chase. I spent about 30 hours coding with DeepSeek V3 as my primary LLM, and it is probably the best AI coding assistant I've ever used.
This development has been described as nothing less than a Sputnik moment by Mark Andreessen, and for good reason. Just as the launch of Sputnik challenged assumptions about American technological dominance in the 20th century, DeepSeek R1 is forcing a reckoning in the 21st.
Well, as we're hearing, DeepSeek's overnight success is a bit of a nightmare for American chipmakers because it's proving that low-cost AI chatbots can excel without expensive U.S.-made technology. NVIDIA suffered the biggest single-day loss in U.S. market history on Monday, almost $600 billion. President Trump said DeepSeek should be a wake-up call for the entire U.S. tech industry.
Today and over the last couple of days, I've been reading about China and some of the companies in China, one in particular, coming up with a faster method of AI and much less expensive method. And that's good because you don't have to spend as much money. I view that as a positive, as an asset. The release of DeepSeek AI from a Chinese company should be a wake-up call for our industries that we need to be laser-focused on competing to win because we have the greatest scientists in the world. Even Chinese leadership told me that. This is very unusual when you hear a DeepSeek, when you hear somebody come up with something. We always have the ideas. We're always first. So I would say that's a positive. That could be very much a positive development. So instead of spending billions and billions, you'll spend less and you'll come up with hopefully the same solution.
Wei Sun is a principal analyst in AI at Counterpoint Research in Beijing, a global technology market research firm. I spoke to her and I asked her, what is so special about DeepSeek?
DeepSeek has a lot of things to offer as a whole package. First of all, its performance is on par with the OpenAI's latest model, which is the GPT-01. So that is a very strong reasoning model to use. And second of all, it's very cheap and affordable to train. I mean, if I can remember that right, DeepSeek actually spent about $5 million on training the model, while the OpenAI spent around $1 billion. So that's a very disruption in terms of AI training. And third, it's open source. So anyone from like anywhere in the world can use it freely. So that's a very big bonus for any kind of users or potential users. And the fourth, it's made very, you know, available and easy to use via the mobile service or the internet browser. So you can just log in and use that for free. So it's a whole package.
You mentioned the low cost, the small amount, relatively small amount of money that went into developing DeepSeek. Should we be questioning that figure at all, though? Did this company, the company behind DeepSeek, did they benefit, for example, from Chinese policies or other Chinese government forms of financial assistance?
The thing is, when DeepSeek released this model, they also released a lot of the training process. So they made it very transparent. So a lot of universities or companies in US has already, you know, replicated the process. So basically, there are a lot of optimization in the system that leads to the low cost of the model, which includes a lot of novel approaches in terms of AI techniques, such as reinforcement learning and things like that. So I would say, no, the numbers is right. It's about right. And there are a lot of low-cost optimizations around the system that made it very, very affordable for companies to train or to use.
You study AI for a living. Did the emergence of this new DeepSeek model, did it catch you off guard as well?
Well, to be honest, it's quite under the radar for most of us. So there's a little bit shocking, but when I studied the architecture, I mean, it uses the, you know, the mixture of experts, architecture and the reinforcement learning. And these things are not new. These things have been there before. It's just the way of the combinations and the way of they doing the training in terms of compromise some of the compute or memory costs with the architecture. There are a lot of novel techniques they've been doing. So yeah, I'm a little shocked too.
Can you tell us about the reaction to this in China? What kind of attention is DeepSeek getting?
I think a mixture of shock, as most of people were shocked, and also a lot of excitement, because if you look at it is also a war between the open source AI software and also the closed source. So DeepSeek choose to open source like everything, the open ways of the models and also the training process to make it transparent. And a lot of the whole global community in AI, especially the ones in China, are very excited to leverage and then, you know, benefit from that. The Chinese market is very application driven, so this may accelerate, you know, the adoption of the AI in a general level.
AI expert Wei Sun, who's with the technology research firm Counterpoint Research in Beijing. Well, what does this mean for China's tech rivalry with the U.S.? Let's get more on this now. Jonathan Cheng is the China bureau chief with the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, we just heard the news of surprise, from words of surprise from our AI analyst in Beijing. Did news of DeepSeek's chatbox catch the Chinese leadership off guard as well, or was this company on the Communist Party's radar?
Well, the founder, Liang, he met with the Chinese premier, I believe it was last week. So he has at least, you know, the Chinese leadership at least is about a week ahead of most U.S. investors. But I sort of share the same general view that I don't think this was conjured up, you know, by the Communist Party in some laboratory. I think, you know, this is a large company. I think it's probably a large country. I think it's probably true of TikTok and ByteDance as well, where, you know, you do have a lot of hardworking, innovative people who are cooking things up. Not everything works out, but every now and then when you have this many people working on things, you're going to have someone come out of the woodwork. And I think once they do, then they very quickly get the attention of the leadership.
It fits really nicely, doesn't it, with Xi Jinping's overall economic strategy called the New Productive Forces Strategy. It's focused a lot of support on dominating high-tech fields. China's already light years ahead in renewable energy, for example. Will this just be more vindication for Beijing and Xi Jinping when it comes to AI?
Yes, I think it is exactly that. I think, you know, the U.S. and China have both identified future technologies as really where, you know, the battle is going to be fought. And yes, renewables for sure, you know, EVs, but you're also seeing it with semiconductors. And all of these are related industries because chips are in everything, including AI, including in EVs. And there's a lot of energy going into these sectors. And yes, this is definitely being read as a vindication, especially since the Biden administration made such a deliberate point about trying to stifle China in this realm by cutting off access to high-end chips that are used in AI. And here you have China basically able to say, well, we got here and we got here faster than anyone would have expected. And we did it even with you guys trying to trip us up.
Exactly. So does this affect, you know, the U.S. government's overall strategy towards China? I mean, as you said, the Biden administration spent a huge amount of time restricting the export of advanced chips to China. Was that just a huge waste of energy?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people that are making precisely that argument now. And I know there's going to be a lot of soul searching in Silicon Valley and Washington, in every Western capital, about how you play, you know, how does the playing field even work? You know, I think what DeepSeek really showed is that it may not just be a matter of how much compute you can get, how powerful your chips are, how much horsepower you have. It's about, in some ways, working smarter, not harder, right? I think that that's sort of what DeepSeek has shown. And, and you know, what people say about necessity being the mother of invention. But I think that's what we're seeing here is that, you know, if DeepSeek and other Chinese AI developers could have gotten easy access to high-end NVIDIA chips, they probably wouldn't have even had to think about trying to find a way around. But because they were forced to, they've gone down this path, and I think faster than anyone could have expected. I think people in the U.S. would have said, yeah, okay, sure, they can find a workaround, but it's going to take them years. It turned out it only took them a couple of months.
Jonathan, how is this being digested in tech circles in China? Will news of this startup success, how will it be digested for tech giants that have been receiving huge amounts of Chinese state support? Is this a bit of an embarrassment for them?
You know, again, I mean, I think if there is any embarrassment, it's going to be mixed with pride and it's going to be mixed with curiosity. I mean, it's a paradigm shift here to say, again, maybe just... it's not about how much money you throw at it necessarily. Surely the money isn't going to hurt. But again, it might hurt because it might lull you into thinking, well, all we need to do is just plow ahead and pour more money into it rather than sort of think laterally, think outside the box. And that's really what we see here is just, you know, not having access to the best chips forces you to have to think about it in a different way. And, you know, I mean, there's also a new avenue that's opened up here because others are going to be able to look at the code and they're going to be able to see how this was done and they're going to be trying to apply it in different ways.
And just briefly, we're hearing that DeepSeek has been experiencing some tech issues. Any update on that?
Well, I mean, when something comes out of the woodwork like this and attracts so much attention, not only do they have a lot of people trying to sign up and download, but yes, it is going to become a target as well. And I think that's probably what we're seeing here. Obviously, it's impossible to speculate on who that is, and I'm not a technical expert or anything like that, but I imagine that they are going to become more of a target. I imagine that they are going to need to really be careful on that front, and
okay.
Maybe that is where the
Jonathan Chung, we'll leave it there. Thanks.
Involved.
Thanks for speaking to us. Jonathan Chung is the China Bureau Chief with the Wall Street Journal. Coming up, the leader of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, Bishop Marianne Budd, explains why she pleaded to Donald Trump to be more sympathetic to migrants.
We were lacking in our public discourse right now mercy, compassion, a recognition of the people in our land who are in places of great vulnerability now. And I made the decision to appeal to the president after acknowledging his power and acknowledging that he had been elected and that he felt spared by God to do this work, that this God was a God of mercy.
Some other stories we're tracking this hour. The United Nations says hospitals in the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo are struggling to cope with the numbers injured in fighting between Rwandan-backed rebels and the Congolese army. And Serbia's prime minister has resigned after months of demonstrations prompted by the deadly collapse of a railway station canopy. You're listening to NewsHour. Well, Donald Trump's first week in office made headlines for many reasons. A flurry of executive orders, a threat to start a trade war with Colombia, and a mass pardoning of the January 6th rioters. But it was also notable for one rare episode of public dissent, not one from the political class, but from the pulpit. Bishop Marianne Budd is the leader of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington. A week ago, at a national prayer service, one of the inauguration events, she used her sermon at Washington National Cathedral to speak of the fear in the LGBTQ and immigrant communities. As Mr. Trump prepared to turn his campaign promise of mass deportations into policy, she addressed him directly.
In the name of our God, I ask you, to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now. They may not be citizens or have the proper documentation, but the vast majority of immigrants are not criminals. I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away.
Watching with his family, Mr. Trump was unimpressed, as he made clear to reporters afterwards.
What did you think of the service?
What did you think? Did you like it? Did you find it exciting? Not too exciting, was it? I didn't think it was a good service, no. Thank you very much.
Thank you, press. Thank you, press.
Later, in a post on his Truth Social platform, President Trump elaborated on what he didn't like, referring to Bishop Budd as a so-called bishop and a radical left hardline Trump hater who had brought her church into the world of politics in a very ungracious way. She and the church owe the public an apology, he concluded. My NewsHour colleague Jamie Kumarasamy has been speaking to Bishop Budd, and he asked her what her thoughts were on writing her sermon.
I had been working with the themes of unity for some time, thinking quite a lot about what is unity in a country like ours, and is it even possible? What some have called the culture of contempt, the outrage that we are so accustomed to now as normative speech, and the ways we characterize each other. So I was trying to address, okay, if we're going to be a country praying and working for unity, we have to have some foundations of dignity, honoring the dignity of every human being. And speaking with humility, because we all are imperfect. And then I realized, as I was listening to my heart and then also listening to the inauguration ceremonies, that there really was a fourth, and that we were lacking in our public discourse right now mercy, compassion, a recognition of the people in our land who are in places of great vulnerability now. And I made the decision to appeal to the president after acknowledging his power and acknowledging that he had been elected and that he felt spared by God to do this work, that this God was a God of mercy.
Given that you say you wanted to speak for those who did not feel included by the president, does that mean you were speaking for people he would consider his political opponents? Was there a political element to this?
The political element is simply that it was a prayer surface for the nation. And whenever we are gathered as human beings, we are in fact gathered in the polis, in the people. So yes, it's always political. It wasn't partisan, and it was based upon very faith-driven values. That is my prerogative from which to speak. I did want to counter what I thought was a gross mischaracterization of immigrants, for example, of being dangerous criminals, because while there are some criminals in the immigrant population, as there are in all populations, it's a very, very small group of people relative to the whole. The vast majority are not criminals at all.
As well as talking about immigrants, you talked about people being scared. I mean, are you scared now?
I'm worried. I have been for some time. I respect the office of the presidency and I respect the results of the election, but I do feel that many of the policies that are now either being reversed or promoted are not in the best interest of our people, of our survival as a species. So yeah, I would say there's good reason for worry.
Personally, though, after the speech and the reaction you got from the president, and I think from some of his supporters as well, does that worry you?
It's no fun being on the receiving end of some of the statements that have been made. But no, I'm very well supported and even protected. There are far more people who are in greater danger than I.
But do you think you are in danger?
No, I don't.
When the president posted that you were a radical left hardline Trump hater, what did you're laughing?
Well, I'm not a radical. I don't hate anyone. I don't agree with much of what the president says or has said or done, but that doesn't make me a hater. I'm 65 years old. I'm a grandmother. And so I think that's more a reflection of the state of the country than who I am, that he would say that.
Are you still confident that the church can be a bridge, can be a unifier?
Well,
that's a long pause, Bishop.
It's the work to which I feel called. I don't know if we will be fruitful in that, but it's the small ways and the on-the-ground ways where the church is unifying. And unfortunately, we have a lot to answer for in our divisions in public life. And I grieve that. I grieve that as much as anyone. And the mistakes that we've all made, do you know? We have a lot to answer for as a church, and I am mindful of that as well. So humility, that's another thing that we all need.
Marianne Budd, the Bishop of Washington, speaking to my colleague, Jamie Kumarasamy. Now, something different. Recognize this? Ah, the sounds of Tetris, that addictive and sometimes stressful computer game where different shaped blocks rain down from the top of the screen, piling up if you don't get them in the right places. Well, it's now 40 years old and still going strong. Hank Rogers is co-founder of the Tetris Company. He spoke to the BBC about how he first came across the game.
It started at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in 1988. It was made originally by a Soviet developer. Nobody thought it was going to be a big deal, least of all the company that actually published it. I went and talked to them and said, look, I want this game for the Japanese market. I would stand in line and wait for my turn to play, you know, every game that was at the show, or try to anyway, and I get a few minutes to play every game. And so I need to sample as many games as possible. In the case of Tetris, I found myself standing in the line four times, which meant that I was hooked to the game. I mean, right then and there, I had to go back. That means we had at least one customer, me. and I was completely hooked on the game. And the simplicity of the game did not bother me because I play a Japanese board game called Go. And if you look at it, it's the deepest, most interesting game of board games, but it's just black and white stones at the end of the day. When finally the negotiations started happening, I was negotiating against the biggest software company in Japan at the time. And they finally passed on it because in 1988, they said that the game was too retro. Can you imagine that? So, by the way, Tetris is still around and they're gone. I think it's going to be around just like football is going to be around forever. Huh. It's not going to go away anytime soon.
That was Hank Rogers, co-founder of the Tetris Company, reflecting on the history of that maddeningly addictive game. Now, don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but you missed the live broadcast, a podcast of the program is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine BBC NewsHour podcast and you'll find it there. Stay with us. Lots more to come in the program. Welcome back to NewsHour. The return of Donald Trump to the White House has raised expectations of peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. president has said it's so important to get that deal done. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 remains the largest war in Europe since World War II. Moscow now controls one-fifth of Ukraine's territory. The UN says more than 12,000 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. Our senior international correspondent Orla Guerin reports now from the southern city of Zaporizhia on how one bereaved family feels about possible peace negotiations.
I'm making my way across the rubble at the side of a building. It's a four-story apartment block and one whole section has been torn off, strewn around here on the ground. You can still see some belongings from those who lived here. I can see a child's shoe, and there's a woman's handbag over there, and a small blue soft toy. Among those who were killed here were several generations of one family.
Один суцільний біль. Це ад на землі.
Yulia Tarasevich stands in the ruins and tells me life now is hell on earth. She lost her mother, Tetiana, who was 68, her daughter, Sophia, 27,
and her grandson, Adam, who was just 17 months old.
When this tragedy happened, the three of them had just come back from a walk. Just at that moment, a bomb fell. It flew into the house and exploded, right there. So in one moment, we lost almost the whole family.
Adam's grandfather, Serhii, tells me Russia's bomb destroyed many lives, and the dead must be avenged. He says Ukraine must fight on, not talk peace.
My view on negotiations is negative. So many of our people have already died. That is no longer possible. If the enemy is on our territory, the only contact we can have with them is combat.
In a cold, windswept cemetery at the edge of the city, we saw the results of combat. All around in the distance there are graves of Ukrainians killed in the war. I was in this graveyard about a year and a half ago, and it's gotten much bigger since then.
Orla Garin reports from Ukraine's southern city of Zaporizhia. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you live from our studio in London. Let's focus now on events inside Gaza. For a second day, Palestinians are filling the Salah al-Din Road, the main highway in Gaza, in order to return to their homes in the northern part of the territory. More than 300,000 people have crossed from southern Gaza into the north so far. Palestinians are finding nothing but destruction on returning home, our teams on the ground report. The United Nations is warning that needs on the ground remain immense. Iman Ayad is a medical student who'd been staying in Deir al-Bala in the south. Yesterday, she managed to return to Gaza City, and she told us what she found.
I think about 500,000 people came from the south. When you walk with that amount of people, you lost your family, you lost everyone you know, and you just walk. And the way home, I don't see anything. I just see the destroyed everywhere. Everywhere there is a destroyed. I cry. I say to my family, is it our house? Oh, my God.
Well, this morning, for the first time since the ceasefire, Jordanian helicopters carrying aid were allowed into Gaza. That sound was recorded by the BBC's Fergal Keane, who was able to join the mission alongside cameraman Moose Campbell, and by doing so, became the first international journalist to go into Gaza. Ever since October 7th, Israel has not allowed any international journalists in Gaza unless they're under the control of and embedded with the Israeli military. Fergal spoke to my colleague Sarah Montague a short while ago.
We took off from an airbase here, where I'm talking to you from, outside Amman al-Zarqa airbase, and flew for about an hour down towards the Israeli border and then across, and landed at an airstrip 500 metres inside Gaza. It used to be the old armistice line between Israel and the Gaza Strip. And, you know, as we came into land, you could see across the barbed wire fence the ruins of Gaza. And looking behind me then, watching Jordanian Air Force men with large boxes of aid rushing. They kept the rotors of the aircraft going continually. That's because there were another 14 choppers waiting to land with aid. There's a real urgency about getting this aid in, and it's particularly because it's medical aid, which can't be sent on the long road convoys and held up potentially and delayed at border crossings. The idea is that this air bridge will bring the aid directly in as close as you can get to the areas where people need it most.
And so will that air bridge just keep operating now?
Well, we're told it's going to go for at least, you know, the next week to 10 days and probably longer. It's certainly, now that they have an efficient system going right here at the airbase, they showed us these huge refrigerators, for example, where they keep the medicine. And so you can get, you know, with goodwill on all sides, with agreements, and of course, critically, with the continuation of a ceasefire, it is possible to get this really badly needed aid. You know, the other thing that I saw this morning was lots of baby formula, which is a thing, again, that if you if it's going on long journeys and is delayed for any reason, can easily spoil. And so it's those sort of essentials which, as somebody who's been following the conflict since the very beginning and focusing on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, you know, I can tell you the need is absolutely huge. It will take many, many such missions, air missions, to do it. Maybe you can hear in the background now, a set of choppers are taking off from here. And that's going to go on all day, and it will start again tomorrow at first light.
And are the Israelis checking everything that's on the helicopter?
I mean, I think there is trust between the two militaries here. Everything that goes is, of course, checked by the Jordanian side at the airbase here. It's flown into the airstrip that we landed on, which can only, I should say, take two choppers at a time. So that, you know, that gives you an indication of the limitations. And then is handed over to the World Food Programme. And everything, you know, one has to work on the basis that everything is checked.
And in terms of what you were able to see, I mean, you know the area. Did you have any sense of how different it is from pre-war?
Well, I think I have probably the sense that anybody who's been looking at any of the images coming out over the last year, but particularly the last few days, you know, when they've been able to fly drones over Gaza. I mean, it's just, there's a moment where our chopper was dipping down to come in, and you could just see this wasteland in front of you. Then when we got in, I mean, we were only allowed between 10 and 15 minutes on the ground simply because of the pressure of choppers arriving. And looking over the border fence, not the border fence, but looking over the barbed wire fence that surrounds the little airstrip, you could just see ruined buildings. That was all there was to see, just ruins. And a few digging machines, they may well have been Israeli digging machines, clearing through the rubble.
Of course, international journalists have not been allowed into Gaza unless they've been embedded with the IDF. Have you had any indication of whether that is shifting, whether we will now see journalists being able to go in and operate freely?
No, I don't see any sign of that. And I think it's quite unlikely to happen. This is just my instinct, and from talking to people on the ground, I think it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. You still have Israeli hostages in there. You still have, to put it mildly, a state of mistrust between the various parties operating on the ground there. And, you know, a long-term question about how much the Israelis actually are willing to allow us see. You know, will we be allowed in, for example, before the work of rebuilding Gaza takes place? I certainly hope we are. This is essential, as it has been from the beginning of this conflict, that we are allowed to bear witness independently.
In terms of the humanitarian effort that is needed now, I mean, we're getting excited over helicopters going in, but the scale of what is required, it's immense.
It's absolutely huge. If you consider that around 2 million people were displaced by this war, you know, roughly around the same number of people dependent on aid, and where you have had an aid operation that is among the most limited I've certainly seen in a long time of covering conflicts. You know, the debate about that, why that happened, why there wasn't more aid allowed into Gaza, is one that will go on and has already created a very, very heated context to this whole question. We've had the United Nations aid agencies accusing the Israelis of deliberately refusing to allow aid in or blocking aid missions, the Israelis denying this, putting the blame on the international community as it operates in Gaza and saying they're the ones who are not distributing the aid. But the answer to it all is, I have to say, let us in. Let us talk to people. Let us bear witness on the ground.
Our special correspondent, Fergal Keane, speaking from inside Gaza and the immense need for humanitarian aid there. For more on this, I spoke with Clemence Lagourdin, Oxfam's head of response in Gaza, who is also on the ground.
We are, our office of Oxfam is in the middle of the humanitarian area and basically surrounded with tents. It's just an immense and huge camp. What we are seeing since yesterday and with the return to the north is that the camps and the tents are disappearing bit by bit. We are seeing people dismantling them and moving with all their belongings back to the north.
And can you describe the emotions among the people that you're seeing? Are they excited to leave and to return home? What's the feeling?
I think it's a mix and a blend of feelings. They are excited, they are relieved, but I think they are also very much aware of what they are returning to, or they are imagining. They know, and I think the word has spread, that the conditions in Gaza City are difficult, that there is a lot of destruction, and that the simple basic services such as water and electricity are not available.
Can you tell me more about the situation on the ground and in the places that Palestinians are returning to?
The places where they are returning to are the places that have become recently accessible, so where the IDF troops have withdrawn. These are the places that were the most populated before and that have suffered the highest degree of destruction. So they are basically returning to piles of rubble, potholes in the road, all the electric poles are not there. And yeah, the most basic commodities and the most basic infrastructure are also damaged or destroyed.
We're hearing warnings today from the mayor of Rafah that some parts are still extremely dangerous. What are you hearing?
There are several dangers around the areas of return. Some of them are the ones that are close to the buffer zone, so we do not encourage population to go back there due to the danger. But there are also explosive remnants of war pretty much everywhere. So we are also trying to even train our staff and pass the messages that going into the rubble, trying to remove that by themselves, present danger because of unexploded ammunition that can remain. And there have been already several casualties in the past few days.
We've been talking about the physical dangers so far, but can you reflect for me on the psychological impact of returning to those sites that people left behind?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I mean, overall, the past 15 months have been incredibly hard for all the population in Gaza. Having to go back to your house, finding it destroyed, having to basically restart from scratch, right? Because people had a bit of services in when they were in the humanitarian areas. Now they are returning. They need to start again. They need to rehabilitate their house. They need to again try to find where to find water, what shops are open, where is the closest health points. So like all their landmarks, everything that they knew before in their neighborhoods is probably not there. And it's also going back to see some relative, finding that some people have passed away. So the trauma that is going to come from this is going to be incredibly high.
And how do you address that, though? Where do you start?
It's going to be a long process and a long road. It's having the what we call here the protection actors. So providing psychological first aid, providing recreational activities, is to allow the children to go back to a routine. So having education activities, and for us, for the humanitarian community, is to provide at least the basic services so people can have a kind of a dignified return, right? So that they don't have to struggle anymore for water. They don't have to struggle for food. But it's going to take time.
Is this just the start of something that's going to be continuing for weeks or for months?
I think we are talking in years. I mean, to restore the infrastructure that were existing before, to remove the 42 million tons of rubble, to be able to bring construction material, to be able to bring pipes, it's going to be an extremely long process. So right now we are putting Band-Aid and patches to try to do quick response, but to do something that is going to be sustainable and that is going to be enough is going to take, months, if not years.
Clémence Lagourdin, Oxfam's head of response in Gaza. And the BBC's Fergal Keane and Moose Campbell are the first international journalists into Gaza with an aid team in over a year. You can read more about their impressions and their trip on the BBC News website. This is NewsHour coming to you on the BBC World Service. And let's get the latest from the Democratic Republic of Congo now. The United Nations says hospitals there are overwhelmed, treating hundreds of injured people in the regional hub of Goma in eastern Congo. For days, the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have been trying to capture the city from the Congolese army. Battles between the rebels and the army are continuing across the city. There are many dead bodies on the streets, and the UN says there are reports of rapes committed by fighters. Just before we went on air, we received this message from a resident of Goma who asked us not to name him.
The war was tense in the city center. There was crossfire and around the airport and in the northern part of the town, that is Turunga and Majengo. It is tense even right now, the other side. But here, people are moving on the streets. People are fetching water from the lake because we have no water. We saw the rebels walking on our way here, on our main road here, towards the town.
That report from an unnamed resident of Goma. But let's go live now to Emery Makomeno, our correspondent in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. That's on the other side of the country to Goma. Emery, let's just start by focusing on Goma. What's the latest that you're hearing from there?
Well, who is in control of Goma is still a big question mark. Of course, you have the M23 still pushing to gain more control of Goma, and you still have a resistance by the Congolese regular army who are supported by the Patriots. These are other armed groups affiliated to the government that have also resisting and resisting the progression of M23. So it's very difficult to know exactly who is controlling Goma even after 48 hours. What is really bad, as the resident said there, is that it's been 5 days. People have been locked inside their houses without power, without electricity, and sometimes internet is being jammed. So it's very, very difficult for people. Many people haven't prepared for this, so they are running out of food, and they badly need the essential water and electricity and just everything so that they can even go out.
So real desperation there. Just to focus in on what's happening in the capital where you are, we're hearing about attacks on embassies. Can you tell us more?
Yes, here in the capital, protesters, I saw several hundreds of them took to the streets. It was very peaceful one at the very beginning, and as the crowd started building up, they started targeting some embassies. They started with the embassy, the French embassy. They put fire and launched cocktail Molotov inside and burned a part of the embassy before they could put that fire off. And then they headed to the embassy of Uganda, where they managed to enter and take away furniture and whatever they could take. Now, as we speak, the police commissioner of Kinshasa has deployed troops to secure embassies, and protesters even looted some shops here and there. So the police is trying to restore law and order, and the government has apologized for everything that happened and promised that they are doing their utmost to restore peace and order in Kinshasa. This was in support of the people who are trapped inside Goma. So the people some protesters say they wanted to show that they sympathize with the suffering that Congolese are having in Goma.
Emery, thank you. Emery Makomeno, our correspondent, speaking to us from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Well, let's finish this edition with the triumph of protesters in Serbia. This was the scene last night in the capital, Belgrade. And now, the news today that Serbia's Prime Minister, Miloš Vučević, has resigned. The announcement follows months of demonstrations like the one you just heard, prompted by the collapse of a train station canopy which killed 15 people. That incident led to allegations of widespread corruption and demands that those in charge be held to account. Well, joining me now from Belgrade is the BBC's Jovana Jovanovski. Jovana, tell us more about the Prime Minister's decision to go. Why did it happen now?
The Prime Minister's resignation was announced just hours after the most radical protest action so far, a 24-hour blockade of one of the main traffic hubs in Belgrade. Thousands of students spend a night there, joined by members of the public. The decision of Mr. Vučević to quit, which is yet to be confirmed by the National Assembly, will end the government's mandate. So two scenarios are now possible. Either the parliament will elect a new prime minister who will form the next administration, or Serbia could face a new round of parliamentary elections. The last elections took place just over a year ago, and they were criticised by the opposition, which complained that they weren't fair and democratic. International observers, including the OSCE, have called for talks between the main parties to improve conditions. But the protesters say not all of their requests have been met. Mm. They demand accountability and legal action against everyone who might be responsible for the railway canopy, Jovana, and there are new protests announced.
Jovana, Mr. Vučević has said that the protests were fueled by foreign powers. Is there any evidence of that?
No, so far the government hasn't offered any evidence of that, and they haven't spelled out who they have in mind.
You said that the protests last night were the biggest we'd seen so far. Is there any reason why they came to a head just now?
So the protests have been building for 3 months now, and it seems that the longer they last, there's growing support, and there are more and more people joining. So there are actually a few protest actions announced for later in the afternoon in several locations in Serbia, which are a reaction to some violent incidents that happened last night in another city, Novi Sad, and partly a reaction to Mr. Vučević's resignation.
Okay, and are we expecting any more resignations?
So the president said before that he's planning to replace about 50 ministers, 50% of ministers in his government.
Okay.
But it's a question now because the government has to step down.
We'll leave that there for now. We're just coming to this edition, end of this edition of NewsHour. But thank you so much to the BBC's Jovana Jovanovski speaking to us from Belgrade. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team here on NewsHour, thank you for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt
for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.